The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Carrie Lawson from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. We're going to start in our wellness section. The article is, "When Western Medicine Failed Me, My Mom Stepped In." Crippled by severe anxiety and chest pain, a young woman found relief where she least expected it. And this article is written by Mandy Montes, M-O-N-T-E-S. When I graduated from NYU in the summer of 2021, I was ecstatic to start building my life in the city. I was moving to the East Village with a wonderful roommate. I worked for a nonprofit organization whose work I admired, and I was eager to find my go-to spots. But my excitement quickly shifted to acute stress about whether I could actually afford to live in the city and be an independent 20-something-year-old. I knew that my parents would support me financially however they could, but I felt that I had to prove to them that I could do it alone. The pressure I put on myself, coupled with having graduated a year into the pandemic when jobs in the media industry were scarce, gave me debilitating anxiety. I spent most days of the week working remotely in bed and experienced drawn-out panic attacks and chest pains that burned so hot and stung so hard that I became sensitive to touch. When I was younger and starting to experience the intensity of period cramps, I relied on ibuprofen and Midol for relief. My mother always made a point to say that natural remedies would work better, but I'd scoff at her suggestions. My mom grew up in Mexico City, and her mother, mi abuelita Tara, had a talent for using natural remedies like organic ointments, oils, and teas to treat pain. When my mom felt nauseous and bloated from her period, my abuelita brewed turmeric and ginger teas for her. When my mom had a sore throat, my abuelita crushed mint leaves into an oil that she would rub on her neck to soothe her cough. This cultural care practice was ingrained in my mom, and she brought it with her when she immigrated to the United States in her early 20s. But as a teenager, I thought her remedies were out of touch. I was a first-generation American who believed that Western medicine had scientifically advanced far beyond my mother's provincial practices. So when my chest pain started, I was sure that my doctors in New York would have the answers. Between the months of July and October that year, my chest pain sent me to the emergency room 4 times and to urgent care 5 times. At first, every doctor seemed determined to find out what was causing them. I had EKG tests and a CT scan and got my blood drawn and analyzed. But when my results returned normal, the doctors would simply discharge me and tell me that I had nothing to worry about. In fact, they didn't think my chest pain was anything more than a routine case of heartburn. "I suggest you take it easy," they'd say. "Drink lots of water, go on walks, and try to ease your stress." Felt as if I was a nuisance, which only hurt me more since I'd laid my trust in the hands of the medical system. Then, at my last urgent care visit in 2021, a doctor finally diagnosed me with costochondritis, a condition where the cartilage that joins the ribs to the sternum gets inflamed. After months of pleading for my pain to be taken seriously, I finally had an answer. But rather than answer my questions about what caused the inflammation, he wrote a prescription for a topical treatment and told me it would ease my pain. I left feeling defeated, and for the first time, a whisper of a thought entered my mind. Maybe my mother was right after all these years. Walking home, I looked back on instances when I'd complained to my mom about physical ailments. Every single time, she came to my rescue without hesitation or doubt, offering natural remedies and restorative practices. I felt instant relief talking to her about my chest pain. Rather than dismiss or downplay it, she asked me to describe my symptoms in detail. A tingling, burning sensation that felt like I was on fire. She concluded that if I was willing to try herbal remedies and breathing exercises, my body would slowly begin to heal. From then on, she'd spend her spare time reading notebooks she'd filled with information on herbal properties and write down ones that would help ease my pain. She'd FaceTime me and show me how to make tea from lavender, turmeric, and ginger. On days when I had intense panic attacks that made it hard to breathe, she'd sit patiently on the other end of the line and guide me through breathing exercises. She'd calmly reassure me that I was going to be okay. And though she didn't understand my pain, she told me it was real and worth paying attention to. In turn, I came to admire her knowledge and realized I could learn to heal myself. She taught me that to figure out how to manage my pain, I had to listen to my body. I'd note when it would spike and write down what I'd been doing that day to create a log I could refer back to. Once I was more familiar with my body and its patterns, I realized that my quest was learning about finding a permanent cure and more about noticing when it was screaming to me for help. This meant that I had to do what I had been avoiding for a while, open up to my parents about my fear of letting them down or falling short of their expectations for how I should be using my degree and living in New York. I dreaded showing my vulnerability to them, but they reminded me that they were proud that I was learning to navigate life on my own. Freed from the pressure to have everything figured out, my chest pain began to fade. Looking back, it's clear to me that suppressing my feelings was directly connected to my physical pain. By the end of 2021, my chest pains had subsided from daily onslaughts to rare occurrences. I'd still have flare-ups that would confine me to bed, curled in a fetal position for hours at a time, but I stayed resolute, knowing I had the tools to manage my pain. With my mom's help, I found a way to wellness that transcended any medical advice I'd ever received from doctors. Being healthy no longer meant popping pills for temporary relief or relying on the medical system. Healing meant tapping into my mother's wisdom and discovering how to care for myself. This is a related article in Wellness, How to Stop a Panic Attack According to Therapists. The good news is that they don't last forever. And this article is written by Casey Clark. I'll never forget where I was when I had my first panic attack. I woke up in the middle of the night in my bed with my heart racing, hands trembling, arms tingling, and forehead sweating profusely. I paced around my bedroom screaming because I didn't know what was going on and thought I was having a heart attack. At the time, I didn't know how to stop a panic attack, so I just hoped it would subside on its own. Luckily, it did after a few minutes, but those were the longest 15 minutes of my life. To this day, I can't tell you specifically what triggered my panic attack, but after a few sessions with my therapist, we think it was stress-induced, thanks to my never-ending to-do list. A panic attack is a physical and emotional response where the body reacts to a perceived threat when one isn't present, says Kristen Gill, MD, a psychiatrist and chief medical officer at Minded, an online psychiatry company designed for women. This can cause feelings of distress, unease, and anxiety that it'll happen again in the future. According to the Anxiety and Depression Association of America, panic disorder affects 6 million adults, or 2.7% of the U.S. population. So it's safe to say I'm not alone in this. Gill adds that women are twice as likely to suffer from panic disorder compared to their male counterparts. The therapists I've talked to say it's a chief complaint among their clients, and it's learning how to stop a panic attack, or, well, slow one down, that is the ultimate game changer. Keep reading to find out more about how to stop a panic attack, according to therapists, and what you'll want to do next time you find yourself or a loved one in this uncomfortable situation. What does a panic attack feel like? Unless you've had a panic attack, it's hard to describe exactly what it feels like. But many therapists receive similar answers when their clients come to them saying that they think they've experienced one. Some common symptoms include the heart beating very fast, physical shaking, and feeling out of reality or constricted, says Kelly McKenna, licensed clinical social worker and anxiety therapist. Kristen Gingrich, licensed clinical social worker and a certified drug and alcohol counselor, adds that some other common symptoms of a panic attack include chest pain, gastrointestinal issues, dizziness, racing thoughts, crying, or increased anger. How to stop a panic attack. If you're reading this, then you're probably interested in learning how to stop a panic attack. Well, you've come to the right place. For starters, panic attacks usually stop on their own after a few minutes, but there are some therapist-approved strategies you can use to expedite the process and relieve symptoms more quickly. Number one, know that it will pass. When you're in the middle of a panic attack, it can feel like the feelings are going to last forever. While that may seem like the case, luckily that's not true. If possible, name to yourself that you are having a panic attack. Tell yourself that these symptoms are a part of an attack that will pass, says Madeline Lucas, clinical content manager and therapist at Real. There is cortisol, the stress hormone, and adrenaline pumping through your system at the moment, and it will settle back to normal soon. Number two, ground yourself. While in the middle of a panic attack, it can be difficult to actually realize what's going on around you. So you'll want to actively pay attention to your environment and stay grounded. Look around your space and name as many things as you can that you see. Feel your butt where you're sitting on the floor. Press your toes into the ground, says Lucas. One of my favorite techniques is butterfly tapping, where you cross your arms across your chest and engage in light, rhythmic tapping left and right. All of these steps will start to activate your parasympathetic nervous system to communicate, I am safe, I am okay. Number three, breathe deeply. You've probably heard the advice to take deep breaths when you're nervous or anxious, but that's particularly important when stopping a panic attack. Paced breathing skills are all about being mindful of our breathing and utilizing timed breathing techniques that will deactivate the parasympathetic nervous system, says Gingrich. The most common breathing technique is 5-7-8-5 seconds in, hold for 7 seconds, and out for 8 seconds, while making sure that your out-breath is always the longest. Additionally, McKenna notes that the act of counting as you breathe helps to shift your focus away from the panic and towards something else, which can help slow it down. Number four, do a tip skill, T-I-P-P, all in capital letters. This skill requires a bit more work than scanning your environment and breathing, but it's been proven effective in stopping panic attacks. The temperature portion of the TIP skill, temperature, intense exercise, paced breathing, and paired muscle relaxation, can be extremely helpful when figuring out how to stop a panic attack, especially with cold temperatures. The three most common ways people use this skill is by holding an ice cube in their hands, taking an ice-cold shower, and submerging their face up to the temples into an ice water bath for 15 to 20 seconds, says Gingrich. This helps to deactivate your parasympathetic nerve system, like a fire alarm for your body, by activating your mammalian dive reflex, which automatically causes your body to slow down, shocking it back into the present moment. Number five, try muscle relaxation. When you're in a heightened state during a panic attack, you'll want to work on relaxing the muscles that are overexerting themselves. McKenna suggests starting at the toes and tensing them up for 5 seconds and then releasing. Using the same mechanism, you'll want to slowly work your way up to the body, tensing and releasing the muscle groups until you feel more relaxed. number 6. See a therapist or a mental health professional. You'll want to consider seeing a therapist or a medical doctor to talk about what may be causing the panic attacks and come up with a specific treatment plan. While that may include a variation of the skills mentioned above, you might find medicine helpful, something a professional can assist with as well as educate you about other treatment options. There are FDA-approved select serotonin reuptake inhibitors, SSRIs, approved for the treatment of panic disorder, says Gill. Medications like Prozac, Paxil, and Zoloft are some of the most popular ones, but you'll want to consult with a psychiatrist to find a medication that works for you. How to help others cope with a panic attack. For some people, panic attacks are a daily occurrence, and for others, they are more infrequent. Regardless of the frequency, people who experience panic attacks can benefit from having support and knowing you are there. Sitting with the person and helping them access skills they might be familiar with, like paced breathing and sensory grounding techniques, and doing them together with them, can be helpful when helping a friend or loved one cope with a panic attack, says Gingrich. Additionally, you can be the voice of the reason in the situation and remind them that they are safe and these feelings will pass. Sometimes hearing it from someone else can help provide a sense of reassurance. On Oprah's Insiders, she has Oprah on how we should all follow Elmo's lead. Hey, Insiders. Did you all see how Elmo the Muppet, hit a nerve this week? He sent out a message on X, formerly Twitter, saying, "Elmo, just checking in. How's everybody doing?" And the response has been pretty wild and astounding. As I speak to you, tens of thousands of people have replied. Even President Biden took time out to write back. Elmo's message elicited what I can only describe as a real outpouring of collective sadness, a tenor of existential despair, all in response to that simple question from a furry Muppet. A lot of people, it seems, are not doing okay. And just what was it about Elmo's question that struck such a nerve? Was it because it came on Monday, at the end of a long January? Was it the headlines of the day? Or was there something more to it? I actually think there's a lot more to it. On Tuesday, Elmo then followed up by saying that he had learned that it was important to ask friends how they're doing. And that is for sure. I couldn't agree more. And it reminded me of a time early on when I first started doing the Oprah Winfrey Show, and people used to just come on and offer so much emotion during interviews. I remember somebody asked me, "Why is it that people cry so easily on your show? What are you doing to get people to cry?" And I said, "I'm not doing anything." The truth is, most people have actually never been asked sincerely, "How are you doing? How do you feel? Tell me your story." I think that's the nerve that Elmo hit. You know, it isn't always easy to know what to say when somebody's going through difficulties. But what I have learned in all these years is that the worst thing you can say is nothing at all. So for this week, let's take Elmo's advice. Check in on a friend and ask for real, "How are you doing?" I'm following in Elmo's footsteps and asking you the same. How are you doing? Let's hear that in the comments. I'm asking you. You ask someone else. Pass it on. We're all taking Elmo's lead. All right. Have a peaceful week and go well. This article is in Skin and Makeup. How your love life affects your skin. Affection and connection really do make you glow. Here's the science behind this Boost Plus products that mimic it. This article is by Isabel Burton. For years, board-certified dermatologist Nicole Hare, and that's H-A-Y-R-E, M-D, could guess when a patient was in a new relationship or riding high emotionally just from their face. "It's not like I'm psychic," she says. "I could just see it. I thought it was because of oxytocin, the hormone we produce when we experience joy, but I wanted evidence." So Hare put together a pilot study that was later deemed some of the year's most important dermatological research. I assessed six female subjects, ages 48 to 61 years old, measuring their oxytocin levels and how good they looked for their age, she explains. The results were astonishing. Higher oxytocin levels were consistently linked to better-looking, healthier skin regardless of age and sun exposure. How oxytocin makes skin healthier? It involves zombie cells. The happy hormone is not only a powerful antioxidant, it has the incredible ability to help stop the destruction of our body's zombie cells. Yes, that is an actual term scientists use for the worn-out cells that wreak havoc inside your skin. Their technical name is senescent cells. To better understand what they are, imagine the cells throughout your body as employees. Eventually, they peter out and stop dividing, and it's time for them to retire. Most do, but some linger in a half-dead, zombie-like state, spewing inflammatory substances that cause wrinkles, sallowness, dullness, acne, all the hallmarks of damaged skin. As if that weren't scary enough, these zombie cells can recruit nearby healthy cells to join them in their march of destruction. But here's the breaking news. Oxytocin binds to receptors in these cells, which shuts down their destructive pathway, says Hare. Surefire ways to boost your oxytocin level. Even more good news. Oxytocin doesn't just stop the destruction. It prevents it from happening in the first place. The hormone keeps you feeling content and calm. It's the antidote to stress, says board-certified dermatologist Mona Gohara, MD. Stress is a huge contributor to the zombie cell process. It drives up your cortisol levels, and because cortisol is an inflammatory hormone, that causes issues like dryness, sensitivity, fine lines, rosacea, and eczema. Hare describes the benefits of oxytocin as a positive feedback loop. The more social and peaceful you are, the higher your oxytocin. That makes you more pleasant, which attracts even more social interaction. And per her research, the healthier your skin looks. To be clear, you don't have to be in romantic relationships or have steady sex to flood your system with the hormone. So many things naturally boost your oxytocin, says Tasneem Bahadia. That's spelled T-A-S-N-E-E-M, and the second name is B-H-A-T-I-A. M.D., an integrative medicine physician and author of The Hormone Shift. Just spending time with friends and family can do it. Hugging, cuddling, even your pet, or a simple caress will give you a bump. So can listening to music you love, meditating, doing yoga, getting a massage, and even eating certain foods like healthy fats, dark chocolate, and lean protein high in B vitamins, she says. Your skincare can battle zombie cells too. Now, you may not have to rely on your own oxytocin level. Several brands have introduced formulas that target zombie cells. The luxury biotech brand Orveda, for example, has formulated a potent blend of fermented plant extracts, proven to stop zombie cells from recruiting healthy cells. Hare's brand, Ketocin, also turns to the power of botanicals, one of which has been shown to bind to and neutralize zombie cells like oxytocin can, and that Ketocin was spelled C-U-T-O-C-I-N. These, plus more of our picks, are below. Whichever you choose, you'll want to apply it morning and night in the a.m., layer over your antioxidant serum, and then add sunscreen. In the evening, apply after your retinol. So the Ketocin Social Exchange Balancing Cream is $159 at ketocin.com. And Orveda, the Omnipotent Concentrate, is $460 at orveda.com. The Acoderma Lunar Glow Illuminate Serum is $120 at acoderma.com. And Timeline the Serum is $224 at Amazon. So today we're going to skip over to the Shondaland magazine, and we're going to take a look at an article called Things I Left in the Water. In this essay, a new swimmer learns about the power of letting go. And this article was written by Alicia Mitchell. It's 7:30 a.m. on a gloomy Tuesday morning in late August, the third day of my vacation on Martha's Vineyard. This is the first day it's rained since I arrived, and I'm standing on the wet sand at Inkwell Beach, shivering from the cold, waiting for the ladies of the Polar Bears Club of Martha's Vineyard to tell us if it's safe to go into the water. The Polar Bears of Martha's Vineyard are a group of African-American men and women ranging in age from 16 to 80 and older. Founded in 1946, the group offers a safe space for black swimmers to come and enjoy the water together. They gather every morning at 7:30 a.m. at Inkwell Beach in Oak Bluffs, Massachusetts, to commune, exercise, swim, meditate, and just be in the water. Oak Bluffs is on the north shore of the island, and many formerly enslaved West Africans made their home there and built homes and successful businesses after Massachusetts became one of the first states to abolish slavery in 1783. Martha's Vineyard was also a part of the Underground Railroad, so Massachusetts has a long history as a welcoming community. Other African Americans flocked to Oak Bluffs from other parts of the country because Shearer Cottage and Inkwell's Beach were listed in the Green Book as a safe space for beachgoers. Famous black artists, writers, singers, and composers found their way to the island, many staying at Shearer Cottage, which Charles Shearer, the son of a slave, opened in 1912 as a welcome space for black visitors vacationing on the vineyard. The north side of the island, though segregated from the predominantly white east side, offered visitors freedom to be their authentic selves. That Tuesday, I'm already near the water, and one of the members yells out, "If you're not a strong swimmer, don't go in. The water is rough." Not only am I not a strong swimmer, but I also can't swim at all. However, that has never kept me from enjoying a splash in the ocean. I've got the basics down. If the water's choppy, jump with the waves. I look back at my best friend. I see the uncertainty in her face and declare, "I'm going in. Are you coming?" She gives me a strong but apologetic no. I take off my zip-up and head into the icy water anyway. When the waves roll in, I remind myself, "Alicia, jump!" We do a 45-minute exercise routine, hitting arms, legs, and core, followed by a secret ceremony for newcomers, which I proudly participate in. The ladies thank everyone for coming, and I pay my $5 yearly fee to become a member of the club and receive my membership card and a tiny, soft, plastic polar bear that fits into the palm of my hand. It's the first time in a long time that I truly feel proud of myself, and I begin planning my next exercise meetup with the Polar Bears Club. It had been almost 3 years since I'd lost my father and husband in the same year, only a few months apart in 2020. It all happened so fast, and afterward I'd been searching for something and trying to find a clear path forward. It was difficult to find light or meaning in anything, and even though great things were happening and my life was taking shape, there was a layer of sadness and confusion that was always present. I'd been in therapy and working through the guilt I felt for quietly quitting my marriage years before my husband's death, and working through the feelings of fear that came with losing my father. Little did I know this summer trip to Martha's Vineyard would be the light I'd been looking for. On this summer trip, my days were filled with sightseeing, beautiful food, drinks, parties, and dancing. But every day I woke up and thought about my experience that Tuesday morning in the Atlantic Ocean and tried to figure out when I could get back to the beach before my vacation ended. A friend I was traveling with expressed that she'd like to experience the Polar Bears Club before we left. So Thursday morning we were up and walking to the beach by 7:15. This morning was much different from that gloomy Tuesday morning. The water was still and the sun was out, shining brightly and dancing over the water. We took off our flip-flops and happily walked into the water with the crowd, which had grown much bigger on this brilliant morning. The meditation began, and I focused on the member guiding us. Her voice was strong but gentle, and in the background, another member began singing a beautiful gospel hymn. At that moment, I knew I was exactly where I was supposed to be. I focused my face up toward the sun, and as tears began to roll down my face, everything that I had experienced in the last few years began to play out, as if I were looking through a viewfinder behind my eyes. Our meditation guide told us to leave all our fears, sadness, uncertainty, disappointment, and struggles in the water. And as I stood there facing the sun, quietly crying, I knew that I had to leave everything that had been weighing me down since 2020 right there and let the water wash it away. The meditation ended, and new members were asked to come to the center for the super secret initiation into the club. Wiping tears from my eyes, I smiled at my friend as she swam to the center circle and took part in this very special part of the ceremony, while I sang and cheered with the rest of the members. When I walked out of the water that morning, I could feel the heaviness leave my body as I reached the sand. I walked out of the water and left everything that had caused me great pain and uncertainty behind. I've thought about my experience with the polar bears every day since I returned home, and I often wonder if these women and men know how many lives they've changed so much. Even now, whenever life feels scary or confusing, I just close my eyes and go back to that water. And whatever is causing me pain or fear, I let it go, leaving it in the water and walking away lighter. This is another article from Shondaland. I found harmony in my mixed-size relationship. TikTok star Alicia McCarville reminisces about her emotional journey from feeling shame about her body to embracing the love she shares with her partner. My path to becoming part of a famous mixed-sized couple started 4 years ago with a trend on TikTok. The sound, "My boyfriend is 10 times hotter than me, check," was going viral. There were hundreds of couples with varying beauty standards posting videos, and there were thousands of comments by people arguing about who was better looking. If you want to see a couple who don't make sense by beauty standards, I thought, I'll show you one. Using the sound, I made my own video shamelessly exploiting my muscly husband. In the clip, I was in the foreground, being my adorable fat self, with Scott shirtless in the background flexing. I uploaded the video and jokingly told him it was going to go viral. Less than a week later, it hit 1 million views and we gained 56,000 new followers. I was fully prepared to sift through horrible comments. Sift I did. The comments and messages were filled with responses like, "This can't be real," "You don't deserve him," and "This isn't going to last long." To my surprise, there were also many comments and messages from people sharing stories about being in their own mixed size or untraditional relationships. At that moment, I realized Scott and I were not alone. Before we knew it, social media actually became a safe space for me to open up about what we and other couples not viewed equally have experienced. After dealing with society's trash beauty standards and false perceptions for the majority of my life, engaging in online conversations about body image was surprisingly easy for me. My husband and I met in high school. We bonded over Taylor Swift's first album. I originally had a crush on one of his best friends who gave me Scott's email. I added him as a connection on MSN. Each day we would rush home and chat for hours. Eventually, our online chats became real-life hangouts. One of those nights we kissed. Almost 17 years later, here we are. We got married in 2016 in my parents' backyard after 10 years together. We have been lucky to grow up alongside each other. We have seen it all together, from losing my job and not being able to afford our phone bills to traveling the world and paying off my sister's debt. Scott has seen me in every single one of my eras, whether I am a star high school athlete, a college student struggling with binge eating, or a TikTok star in love with whom I've become. My journey with my body is just another element of our love story. For many years, my body fluctuated, and so did how I felt about myself. However, no matter how rough my relationship was with myself, Scott's love and support never wavered. My own relationship with my body began to change in 2018 when our friend invited us to stay with them in Florida. We had never been there. Despite knowing this meant I'd end up on a beach for the first time in 12 years, I agreed. We went to Walmart and I tried on what felt like 1,000 swimsuits. I picked out a black one with mesh cutouts on the side. I packed it, and on the third day in Florida, we went to the beach. Scott and I spent 2.5 hours in the water, riding the waves and playing like kids. It was one of the best days of my life. That evening, we returned to where we were staying. I got in the shower and fell apart. I was mad, sad, frustrated, confused, and yet somehow overwhelmed with joy. While standing there naked in the shower, I was mad that I had held myself back. I was sad that I had made my husband miss out on such happiness. I was frustrated that I had been worried about nothing, and I was confused as to what to do next. It was that moment, standing there in the shower, that I decided that I wasn't going to allow how I felt about my body to negatively affect the people I care about or who care about me anymore. How many nights out with friends did I decline? How many moments with loved ones had I missed? How many photos did I not take with the people I love that they'll never have because of me? There are years of my life when I don't have a single photo of me. It's as if I didn't exist. When I got home from Florida, I bought myself a little journal. Every day, I challenged myself to write down something I liked about myself. It could be as minor as how my hair looked that day or how well I handled dealing with a customer at work. All of a sudden, I had this book filled with all of these great things about me. Good under pressure, great at understanding my emotions, wonderful at validating other people's emotions, fun to be around. These are the reasons why my friends want to hang out and pose in photos with me. These are the reasons why my husband wants to go to the beach with me. No one wants me around specifically because of my body. It's because of that journal that I no longer say no to hanging out, and I don't double-check photos anymore. I realized that if my body ceased to exist or dramatically changed, nothing in that book was going to change with it. That little book helped me separate who I am from how I look. From then on, my perspective on myself shifted. I started placing values on the elements inside that book and challenging myself to understand why I was saying no. Ultimately, I stopped making decisions for my body out of hate, and I started making them out of love, admiration, and appreciation. When you make decisions out of love, those decisions are kind and sustainable. I've had to learn to talk to myself like I'm speaking to my little sister, and I have spent so much time curating my social media feed to honor myself with those who make me feel good about who I am every single day. While I have done the work on myself, the size difference between me and Scott continues to be a hot topic for others. Our biggest challenge in being in a mixed-size relationship is listening to other people's perceptions of us. We do everything in our power to not allow the awful judgments to seep in our reality. Often because people don't understand our dynamic. They'll try to find ways to devalue Scott, like claiming he is hiding being gay or cheating on me. Little do they know I've already thought these things to myself. There were times I believed that there was no way my husband could possibly love me. I spent years of our relationship projecting how I felt about myself onto him and pushing him away. As a couple, we've learned to embrace the things that make us different. I have found movement that works for me and accepted that it looks different from Scott. I have learned to stop carrying shame about what we've had to navigate differently in our mismatched bodies, such as intimacy. When I let go of the narrative that we were impossible and latched onto the idea that we were unique, it allows us the space to find what worked for us. The beauty of our relationship is that I know my partner doesn't base my value on how well I fit into society's beauty standards. He values me because of the type of partner I am. I show up for him every day and make him feel good about himself. His love for me has never changed, and I know that's because it doesn't and will never fluctuate with my physicality. Our bodies are not consistent. It makes absolutely no sense that society would place so much value in bodies that won't always look the same whether it's tomorrow or 50 years from now. How we feel about our bodies should not hold us back from being loved or living our lives. Now that I live in this glorious space of positivity, it's important to know that I also live in a space of grief. There's a grief that comes along with finding happiness with your body and yourself. When I say yes to something that I said no to for years, I'm grieving the loss of the joy that could have come with it. I truly don't wish such grief on anyone. The sooner you start saying yes to being loved and living your life, the sooner you'll realize what you've been missing out on. This next article in Shondaland is, "After being lonely for 3 years, I finally found my people." This writer discusses what it took to find deep, meaningful friendships. And the author is Zany Marulo Stefgen, Steffgen. "I didn't realize I was lonely until the summer of 2022, when I had exciting news and no one to share it with. Within the span of a couple days, I'd been shortlisted for a travel writing award, and I learned I would be flown across the country to take part in a documentary. But when I picked up my phone, I couldn't think of anyone to reach out to other than my family and husband. Until that point, I had explained away all my alone time with the reassuring thought, we're still in a pandemic. After all, it wasn't like I didn't see anyone. I waved hello to people I knew when walking through town, and made small talk before yoga class, video chatting with friends who lived far away, and spent quality time with my husband. I was being safe by not meeting up with people, right? But when it came to sharing my joy, I had no one to turn to. With that realization, I felt almost unbearably alone. Before the pandemic, loneliness was not something I experienced much. At Phillips Exeter Academy, the boarding school I attended on a scholarship for my last 2 years of high school, I'd had a tight-knit group of friends. And after graduation, when I worked in a restaurant, I became close with my coworkers right away. When I moved to Cambodia at age 20 after backpacking there and falling in love with the city of Siem Reap, I joined a multicultural expat community with friends from a dozen or more different countries. In Cambodia, friendships were different than I'd ever experienced before. There was little privacy. Often when I woke up in the morning, there were already local or expat friends waiting in my house for me. But there were plenty of people I could rely on and who could rely on me. When severe health issues prompted my return to the U.S. in 2019, my now husband, who is German and lived with me in Siem Reap, had to find a place that would sponsor his work visa in order for him to join me. That place was the Telluride Ski Resort in the mountains of Colorado. The transition from a big city in a developing country to a small, ritzy ski town was jarring, and soon culture shock became my first barrier to creating friendships. I couldn't seem to reconcile the great wealth and entitlement I saw around me with all I had experienced in Cambodia, and my inner turmoil during this time pushed me into isolation. Even so, I managed to make friends with my coworkers at the Après Ski Bar, where I bartended. We'd meet up for drinks and game of pool after shifts, ride the public transportation gondola to and from work together, and have one another's backs when hordes of skiers crowded around the bar each afternoon. But then the pandemic hit. Studies have shown that the COVID-19 pandemic led to greater levels of loneliness around the world, which makes sense considering that many of us were cooped up for years by lockdowns or caution as we avoided social settings. In the United States, however, loneliness has persisted beyond the pandemic, turning into a public health issue. Studies show that a lack of social connection can lead to serious physical health issues, and that people ages 15 to 24 are the most affected. I was 22 at the peak of young adulthood when COVID-19 made its way to Telluride. And the connections I had built in my home and over just a handful of months were severed as we all retreated into our homes. As soon as they could sense that this virus was here to stay, 4 or 5 of my closest friends in Telluride moved away, called back to their hometowns or headed for places with cheaper rent while they waited out the pandemic. Weeks passed without me seeing anyone in person other than my husband. Then months passed as I stayed away from public spaces, compelled by my disability due to cystic fibrosis to be more careful than most. In the summer of 2020, I started a new restaurant job and made friends with wonderful coworkers. But when I left that job, nearly a year later, most of these connections slipped away. Didn't help that my career, freelance writing, was one that naturally includes a lot of solitude. The longer I stayed lonely, the more ashamed I felt, and the harder it was to get out of my comfort zone and meet people. I was in my mid-20s, after all. Wasn't that supposed to be the phase of life for deep friendships? Was there something wrong with me that so few of the people I knew seemed interested in meeting up? Wasn't it too late to use the pandemic as an excuse? Scrolling through Instagram, I saw post after post celebrating close friendships that, it seemed, everyone else in the world managed to have but me. I felt bitter when I saw these photos and was resentful of my life in the ski town, but I also couldn't figure out if I had anyone but myself to blame for my isolation. Although my husband had initially struggled to make friends in Telluride for the same reasons I had, over time he'd become close with his coworkers. I hung out with them when I came by for drinks at the bar during my husband's shifts and eventually rekindled a friendship with one former coworker of my own, but my loneliness hung over me even when I was around other people. I felt out of place, too shrouded in my self-pity to enjoy the few connections I did have. To make matters worse, I was dealing with a health crisis as 2021 rolled into 2022 with hospitalizations, surgeries, and intense pain and fatigue. At the same time, I was also navigating the first years of marriage with no one to lean on outside of my home. I didn't want to seem needy by reaching out to my casual social connections about anything serious, but without a community behind me, all the hard stuff just felt harder. Spurred by discontentment and the need to live closer to my doctors to deal with my health problems, my husband and I decided to move away from Telluride at the end of 2022. He had more to leave behind than I did, but was already ready for a change. So we drove our moving truck more than 400 miles away to the small city of Fort Collins, north of Denver, a mere hour and a half drive from the hospital where I received treatment for cystic fibrosis, rather than the day-long journey each way to and from Telluride. Upon arriving in a new city, I took matters into my own hands, determined to find a community, or at least not stand in my own way of developing friendships. I started on Meetup, a site where various groups post in person and online events that are open to the public. There were all kinds of offerings that piqued my interest: Italian and German conversation groups, writing meetups, hiking events, and women's circles. I joined Bumble BFF and, despite my discomfort with swiping on potential friends, started a new conversations and met up with different girls for lunch or coffee or drinks. After years of loneliness, I began to question the social etiquette that had felt so natural to me years before. Am I holding eye contact too long? Chewing too loudly? What do I say when there's a lull in the conversation? How do I know when to go home? But I pushed through my discomfort and tried to show up as the most open and authentic version of myself. It worked. Almost a year has passed since I moved away from Telluride and attempted to overcome my loneliness, and I've built a thriving social life. I joined an Italian conversation group who meet once a week, speaking the language I learned when living in Italy as a teen and reconnecting to a part of my life and myself that makes me feel my best. Thanks to a shared love of Italy, I found close friends within the group. And when I was hospitalized before surgery earlier this year, two of them drove an hour and a half to bring me lunch and sit with me for a while. And I've met up with some for hikes or paddleboarding or drinks over conversations in both English and Italian. One of the women I met on Bumble BFF started an article group for those of us seeking female friendships. And at our meetings, I've realized that despite my assumptions, I wasn't the only one who struggled to build a social life in the aftermath of the pandemic. We now keep up a group chat where we encourage one another, exchange photos, and plan together. Best of all, whether connected to loneliness or not, my health problems have lessened and my energy is renewed. I've also come to see friendship somewhat differently. After the whirlwind of life changes I'd been through, by the time the pandemic hit, moving to and from Cambodia, changing careers, getting married, I was craving intimate friendships like I'd enjoyed in the past, with people who really got me. At the same time, I wondered how anyone could understand me after all I'd experienced. I'll admit that I judged potential friends too harshly. They'd never been out of the country. How can they understand what an impact living in Cambodia had on my life? They're single and dating. Can they really relate to me now that I'm married? My loneliness also happened to coincide with a particularly difficult phase of life. Early adulthood, when many people begin to dig into their careers and their partnerships, shifting focus away from their social lives. At the time, all of these forces seemed to be conspiring against me. Now that I've found my place in the new community, however, I have a new perspective. I've learned that friendship can be as simple as doing fun things together or showing up when it matters. I no longer expect friends to automatically get me, but I also lean into my judgment enough to not nurture friendships when they don't feel good. Instead, I appreciate the value of experiencing life alongside someone else, regardless of how much we have in common. As for the phase of loneliness, maybe I needed that alone time during a period when both the world and my life were changing, or maybe it will remain a sore spot in the history of my existence. Either way, I'm sure glad to have the support of a community now, no matter what comes my or our way. Back over to Oprah Magazine in Culture and News, King Charles has cancer, Buckingham Palace announces. He will step back from public duties while he undergoes treatment. This article is by Emily Barak. King Charles has cancer, Buckingham Palace has announced. He will step back from his public-facing duties while he undergoes treatment. During the King's recent hospital procedure for benign prostate enlargement, a separate issue of concern was noted. Subsequent diagnostic tests have identified a form of cancer, the palace said. His Majesty has today commenced a schedule of regular treatments, during which time he has been advised by doctors to postpone public-facing duties. Throughout this period, His Majesty will continue to undertake state business and official paperwork as usual. The palace added the King is grateful to his medical team for their swift intervention, which was made possible thanks to his recent hospital procedure. He remains wholly positive about his treatment and looks forward to returning to full public duty as soon as possible. His Majesty has chosen to share his diagnosis to prevent speculation and in the hope it may assist public understanding for all of those around the world who are affected by cancer. It is not prostate cancer, the palace shared, though they have not specified what type of cancer it is. Last week, King Charles was discharged from the hospital after receiving treatment for an enlarged prostate. He was admitted to the London Clinic on Friday, January 26th, for the surgery, and spent 3 nights in the hospital. At the time of his discharge, the palace said he would like to thank the medical team and all those involved in supporting his hospital visit and is grateful for all of the kind messages he has received in recent days. In a separate statement before his surgery, the palace said, His Majesty would like to thank all those who have sent their good wishes over the past week and is delighted to learn that his diagnosis is having a positive impact on public health awareness. He rescheduled and postponed upcoming engagements for a period of private recuperation, and over the weekend he was spotted attending Sunday services at Church of St. Mary Magdalene on the Sandringham Estate. Meanwhile, Kate Middleton is continuing to recuperate at home at Adelaide Cottage in Windsor following her abdominal surgery. Prince William, who postponed his engagements to care for her, is set to return to public duties this week. Upon Kate's discharge from the hospital, Kensington Palace said, The Prince and Princess wish to say a huge thank you to the entire team at the London Clinic, especially the dedicated nursing staff, for the care they have provided. The Wales family continues to be grateful for the well wishes they have received from around the world. In an earlier statement, they shared that they would be keeping Kate's diagnosis private, saying she hopes that the public will understand her desire to maintain as much normality for her children as possible, and her wish that her personal medical information remains private. Town and Country does report, however, that her condition is not cancerous. So, a romance novel recommendation, Trouble by Lex Croucher, C-R-O-U-C-H-E-R. Have you ever wondered what The Sound of Music would be like with fewer children and a governess who describes herself as 80% dreadful? Well, we can all be glad that Lex Croucher has, because reluctant governess Emily is a prickly force to be reckoned with. When Emily's chronically ill sister Amy becomes too sick to take her new governess position, Emily replaces her, prepared to lie and, yes, steal to make the money her sick sister desperately needs. Her plan is to make zero friends, inspire zero children, and have zero two-franc conversations with widowed Captain Edward. Instead, Emily finds herself teaching about the inner workings of mills, helping save shipwrecked sailors, and getting tied up in a bit of unfortunate blackmail. Croucher's characters are wonderfully diverse, and bisexuality and transness are celebrated, even as they present challenges for their Regency characters. Emily is a bit of a feral cat who doesn't trust you as far as she can throw you, but have some patience with her, set out a few treats, and settle in, because the reward of this delightful book is enormous. In Oprah's Favorite Things, she has the Gifts of the Week, Truff White Truffle Gift Set. Truff can do no wrong by me. I've given the hot sauce to a lot of people. This is Truff's new set, a white truffle oil and hot sauce combo pack that's chef's kiss so delicious. $65 at Amazon. We've run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Carrie Lawson, and reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. Again, that number is 919-832-5138. So long until next time.